I was playing Scribblenauts on my iPhone. So that
Scribblenauts
was,
is great.
Yeah, I lost my DS version along with my DS Lite and a bunch of other, pretty much all my other games. So this was, it was nice to be able to play Scribblenauts. I was really happy that I could give the farmer a llama, and he was happy about it.
Hey.
I don't know.
Okay, anyway.
Anyway.
Shall we begin?
Let's begin. So, hey, Vink.
Yep.
Do we sound streamier to you at all?
I don't know. I feel a bit like I'm floating through the internet right now.
That could be because you are, because we just got approved for Stitcher.
Stitcher?
Yeah.
What's that? Stitcher. That sounds like a sewing circle.
All right. No. It's a streaming audio service for sweet podcasts like ours. That you can download for your mobile device.
I see.
Yes.
But I already listened to this sweet podcast on my mobile device.
True. But you don't have to download and sync this way. I guess that's a bonus, maybe? I'm not really sure. But I'm not sure if you can see our show notes through Stitcher.
You can.
You can? Oh, well, there you go.
But the formatting is lousy.
Oh, okay. So if you want real formatting, you can continue to go through our feed or iTunes. And, of course, always visit our show notes at famicondojo.tv. But I guess, let's say someone just found this by listening to Stitcher. This would be the first episode that they would possibly, a new episode they would hear. Like, what is a Famicom Dojo and why are they on this show?
Well, I think the main thing that we have to go over first is that a Famicom is the name of the 8-bit Nintendo in Japan.
Yep.
And a dojo is a place where you go to learn things like karate, pronounced for our American listeners as karate.
Whoa, it just blew my mind right there.
Oh my gosh. You know what? In Japan, are Pilates called Pilates? I think the answer would be no. But
I'm disappointed now.
But this is where you go to train. What do we train here?
Your game. We train gaming. We train gamers' knowledge. We train gaming skills, mostly just knowledge. But we're diving into the skill realm a lot more because primarily, first and foremost, ostensibly anyway, we're a video web series that does this sort of thing. But our weekly podcast is more about contemporary issues, and then you and me just chatting about stuff. You know, good old times, like between a couple of guys who know way too much about the history of video games over the last 30 plus years.
And getting into those pro tips. I'm gonna give you the first one now. You gotta subscribe to the podcast to get the rest. But
yeah,
it's up, up, down, down. I don't want to spoil it, but the rest is pretty good too.
Oh man. You're going to shake it up with, like, a different dimension, I bet.
Oh, yeah. I don't want to give anything away. But for those of you who read the book, you know this.
So what are we talking about this week? Okay, how about this? Have you played any Diablo 3?
Am I in the minority if I say no?
Because, I haven't either. I am a Blizzard fan, but I'm more of the craft type. You know, the StarCraft 2, Warcraft 2.
I really only played the original Diablo like a little bit.
Oh yeah.
I'm not exactly sure why, actually, because it looked like a really, really fun game.
Yeah, I think I'm more familiar with like the cinematic from Diablo 2 than I am with the actual game and the gameplay. And then like the Warcraft 3 cinematic came out and so that was more amazing. I guess so. It pulled me away.
It's like Diablo and Diablo 2 were like released like 1 or 2 years apart, like really close, and then Diablo 3 was like a decade later.
Yeah. Well, StarCraft and StarCraft 2 were really far apart as well. what has Blizzard been doing in the meantime? They paired up with Activision. Like, there was a merger, right?
Yeah.
I guess you can fill a lot of that gap with World of Warcraft.
I would say so, because, I mean, I think their major projects have been, like, expansions to that. I mean, that's their cash cow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Although, apparently, Diablo sold more than 6 million copies in its, like, opening, like, since it's been out.
Unfortunately, nobody can play it, is the problem.
Well, I mean, people didn't pick it up to play.
Well, I guess not nobody. Well, I mean, this is why I bring this up, because the whole thing of developer worship, and this has to do with, you know, not just entire studios, but, you know, like, personalities within those studios. BioWare is another good example of a whole company. You know, Miyamoto, like, being a figurehead like almost everyone knows, I would think, in the gaming industry. But, like, Blizzard in particular, like, they only released, like, 3 games, maybe, when I like first played, like, man, did I play Warcraft before Warcraft 2 came out? I'm not really sure, but like they made their name on, like, very few games being released, essentially, like, compared to other big studios, and they self-published too, right? So that was huge.
Well, yeah, but I mean, they had console games before they got into the computer.
Oh, okay.
Nuttiness. Like, okay, this is not a great example, but I mean, they were behind the Boogerman franchise.
Oh, well. Yeah, I guess like other companies, yeah, like Rare and Square and anything else that rhymes in air, they made a bunch of stuff I wasn't aware of before, you know, like their bigger titles. Like Rare did stuff before Battletoads. Well, they did Battletoads in the first place, which I'm not sure a lot of people know about Rare, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they made the Rare did console ports of Sesame Street titles. They did, like, all kinds of interesting, yeah, stuff.
So their roots are kind of hidden from what, like, most people know them for, their big killer apps and stuff. But, like, Blizzard in particular, you know, that's kind of their strength, right? And that's why they, yeah, like, weren't, like, an acquisition of Activision. It was, like, an outright merger. So like, people like me tend to want to credit them a lot for, like, being the thing that keeps Activision's, like, reputation afloat or something. That's, yeah, you know, there's these corporate suits in Activision who were, as we revealed in earlier episodes of the podcast, spinoff employees from Atari from back, was it the 70s or was it the early 80s? I don't remember exactly.
I believe it was the early 80s.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, they were to become the first third-party developer.
Yep. And so, you know, despite that they were, like, one of the fresh new faces in the early days, you know, they had this kind of image of, like, being this huge stoic behemoth that's, like, trying to fight with EA, which is also a quite old publisher, to be, like,
yeah,
the number one thing out there. And the Blizzard merger, I think, is what vaulted them into number one, finally, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe so. But, so, I mean, well, for third-party publishers, of course.
Right. But like, I bring up Diablo 3 because it's really easy for people to be like, well, you know, the Diablo series or any, you know, Blizzard series is amazing, and everything that the developers do is right. And anything that makes it seem like kind of corporate and hackneyed, like requiring everyone to go through Battle.net, even if they're playing single player, and then not, yeah, being able to play because the servers are crashing, is something Activision would do, and it's all their fault. And I remember this being a similar issue for things like StarCraft 2, where everything, yep, had to go through Battle.net. You couldn't do local multiplayer anymore. Even that had to go through Battle.net. And then basically the response that you would hear from people in the know was that, no, you see, the people on Activision's board are the Blizzard people. They're one and the same. You can't really credit one without the other. And I think developer worship can kind of blind people to what's really going on behind the scenes.
Well, it happens. I mean, it happens that way with Japanese companies too. You know how Square and Enix merged.
Right. Yeah.
Like whenever there's like a cash grab or whatever, like with Final Fantasy 14 or something.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, they need to listen to the Enix side more.
Right.
You know, whatever, because, you know, or when you know they take a Dragon Quest game and there's like a kind of a cheap cash in.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, that's a Square influence right there, because, you know, because right. I mean, Square whores out its Final Fantasy series like nothing. You know?
Mm.
Final Fantasy presents 10-pin bowling, you know.
Well, like, and those of us who like grew up with those companies being separate is kind of this huge thing, because like a Dragon Warrior, aka Dragon Quest, and the Final Fantasy series were rivals. You know, it's weird they're under the same banner now.
But I mean, now they've been together for so long.
How long has it been?
2003, I think. 2004. I mean, like,
yeah, so almost a decade. Basically,
after Final Fantasy X came out. Think maybe after 10 too, but like long before 12.
Right. But on the other hand, I think that merger kind of brought the Dragon Quest series back in. Well, because they call it Dragon Quest in America now too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, you know, we went from like Final Fantasy 3 to Final Fantasy 7 without knowing why right away. And then we went from like Dragon Warrior. Well, 3 was the last one that was released here? I don't remember for sure. Four was the last one?
We got 4 on the NES, but a really limited run of it.
Yeah, and then you go to Dragon Quest IX. Is that even like the same series? Probably a person wouldn't know that.
No, we got 7 and 8.
But did we? Man, you're right.
In America. 7 for the PlayStation.
9 is just the newest one. I remember the eight launch being big. Yeah.
Eight was big because, like, if you bought the game, there was a disc included with a demo for Final Fantasy or something.
Tons
of people bought the game just to get the demo or the video or something.
No, that's clever. Yeah,
that is clever. But and that's the thing though, Enix never really was able to market very effectively in America. But Square was. But the thing is, like, some people will buy a game just because it says Square. Getting back to developer worship.
Sure, right.
And the games labeled Square are often more expensive than other games.
Oh yeah, like, so like, for those who don't know, like in Japan, there's like no standard pricing for a lot of games. They're kind of all over the map.
A lot of Nintendo first party games come out at about, I don't know, let's see, with the conversion rate, about, I don't know, $45.
Okay.
But like a new Final Fantasy can come out at $100.
Oh, wow. Wow, really?
I mean, and that's for like a regular edition.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we're used to like collector's editions in the States, like with helmets or tins or whatever else. But yeah, wow. All right.
But I mean, yeah, just the regular edition. But the thing is, it's kind of crazy because if you wait a couple weeks, it's going to drop like crazy.
Mm. Yeah.
Like a game like Final Fantasy 13-2.
Mm.
It came out at like, I think it was about with a conversion rate about $97.
Wow.
And then within 3 weeks, I saw copies for $20. New.
Wow. Okay.
Because like a game like that, like these hardcore RPGs, you know, They're attracting like the first day can't wait type of sales. Mm-hmm. The people who need to play it and beat it before they can go on the message boards to talk about it. You know what I mean?
I desperately wanted to be that guy for like Mass Effect 3 when that came out, but just didn't have time. You know, what with being a new father and all.
The reason the price drops so dramatically, is that the games cost a lot of money. But if you take it home, you beat it, and you resell it really quick, you can get almost, in Japan, this isn't GameStop. In Japan, you can get back a good percentage of your money.
Right, okay.
Like if it's a game that's still like in demand, you know, you can get like 70% of your purchase price back.
Oh, that's crazy.
I know, it's nuts. And in some cases, if the game is like totally sold out everywhere, and you know the demand strongly outstrips supply, a brand new game you can get back like almost 100%.
Wow, yeah, because
they're going to sell it at a markup.
Right, yeah, they're going to sell it for more than the new game costs, because you can't get a new game anymore.
Exactly.
Oh my god.
But so like, there's a heavy incentive for people to get the game and instantly sell it, and I mean I think it's good for gamers, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. Because the company gets their profit right away, and and other gamers get a chance to play. Well, maybe it's not good for the companies, but it's great for gamers,
right? Yeah, it's kind of the same in the States in a way, because a lot of third party titles will drop in price. Like, there'll be like sales at Best Buy or Target or other places that'll like cut $15-$20 off.
Yeah.
Not too much after launch, and then after a few months, you might find it for $20-$30, $10, or $5. Poor Konami in there. their guitar whatever game.
Yeah.
But
for any game with the guitar, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, these days, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Harmonix, man, that is a case of developer worship for me. Let me tell you. Have you heard this? So there's going to be a new piece of DLC this summer for all Rock Band tracks that will let you play at like frequency.
Really?
Yeah, I totally forget what it's called, but I should I'll ask Phil Bond. Our,
frequency or amplitude?
Probably more like amplitude, but he said frequency. Yeah. So
for those not in the know, frequency was a I don't know, was it popular? I mean, I know it was popular among our circle, but was it popular in general?
I really don't think it was, but I think it was enough to like kind of start Harmonix's model of taking a song, like breaking it up into those different tracks,
yeah,
and then sort of making a game out of it. And in frequency and amplitude, it was more of an abstract sort of play style. You just had three buttons on the controller to push, and like I guess kind of a stylized spaceship type thing, at least in amplitude. And like tracks are supposed to activate, quote unquote, to get the whole song into play. And the better you do, the more points you get, etc. Which was really crazily addictive for me. And they had a lot of like dance music and hip hop and garbage. I mean, like the bands.
It was really one of the first like Western produced music games.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't even think about
because,
it that
way. There'd been music games before. Dance Dance Revolution.
Samba de Amigo, yeah.
Samba de Amigo. But, like, all had met with very limited success in the States. And this was the first one, like, by an American developer. Was it? Harmonix are American.
Yeah, right? They are, yeah.
Okay. To do, you know, well enough to get a sequel. And then, of course... Then, of course, Guitar Hero and the rest is history.
I mean, I remember getting Amplitude as a demo in, like, PlayStation Magazine or whatever. Like, I don't buy that. I don't buy magazines in general, actually. But I got that because I knew that the Amplitude demo was coming. Wow. And, I mean, I got to say I enjoyed Frequency more, honestly. So I'm really hoping that this Rock Band thing is, like, more like Frequency than Amplitude. So for those who don't know, the whole kind of arc of history for this is that they partnered with Red Octane, was it?
Yes.
To make Guitar Hero.
Red Octane is a company that's not really a game developer. It's it was a console accessory maker, right?
Yeah. So they made the first two Guitar Heroes, which were crazy, crazy popular. And I'm not sure where the schism started exactly. Did they get, like, bought by MTV, like, right after that? Or, Activision. We come back to Activision here. Activision bought the Guitar Hero franchise, did not sign on Harmonix, or didn't have the force.
I think they offered to sign on Harmonix.
Okay.
But, like, yeah, I have to research that. But I know there was bad blood.
Yeah, yeah. So they got Red Octane, and Red Octane kept making the controllers, which, you know, from a construction standpoint, I felt were superior to whatever Rock Band did.
Yeah.
But then, you know, not having their hardware developer anymore, Harmonix went out to MTV or whatever whoever they're owned by.
EA.
EA,
Rock
that's
Band
right.
EA.
Oh, it's all coming back to that, you know, Clash of the Titans thing again.
Yep.
So now you have Activision and you have EA with their competing standards, DLC
and
tracks.
Konami going, hey, we invented this. And they made a game too. They made a game.
Yep.
In America. And everyone went, ha, Guitar Hero ripoff. And they're like, but.
Guitar Freaks was the original, definitely. Yep. There's a crazy video of me playing it in 2006 and failing horribly. It was one of the most watched videos at the time I released it on the YouTube channel. I should link that in the show notes for anyone who wants to see that for whatever strange reason. But yeah, me and Vink 6 years ago in Japan.
Wow, has it been that long?
It has been that long. 6 years ago as of a couple weeks from now, as a matter of fact. Maybe just one week from now. Wow, that's hard to believe. But, you know, Harmonix did the first full Rock Band set, you know, the all four instruments, and Guitar Hero 3, it's just the two guitars, same formula as 1 and 2, still sold pretty well, but that just touched off a whole arms race. And me being the huge developer worshiper of harmonics I was, I followed them through Rock Band and pretty much abandoned Guitar Hero after 3 came out.
Well, everybody did.
Yeah.
The bubble burst. There was just...
Yeah.
People couldn't handle the twice-a-year updates, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, there was... So yeah, from 2005 onward, there was a new title every year for about 6 years.
No, there was like 5 years. Two a year, you know.
Well, if you count both Guitar Hero and Rock Band coming out around the same time every year, and then each of them had a, like, kind of an add-on pack and a whole bunch of DLC.
Well, like there was Beatles Rock Band,
right? But that came out instead of like Rock Band 3 that year, and then Rock Band 3 came out the year afterward.
I suppose.
And then there's like Lego Rock Band in the middle of that somewhere.
Yep.
You know, and
and then of course like EA screwed the pooch with the Wii, which was the popular system at the time.
Oh,
releasing just
yeah.
a port of the PS2 version of Rock Band. Like
right.
a totally gimped non-online, you know.
Right. And well,
and they fixed it with Rock Band 2, but a lot of the fans went
Well, here's part of the problem, right, is that the Wii didn't really do DLC that much, and it had a lot to do with the limited 512 megabyte onboard storage. You had SD cards, but you couldn't run applications
Don't
off of it.
Say anything bad about Nintendo.
I know, right? There's more developer worship right there. But as hardware developer, well, you know, I guess both hardware and software. But like, you know, one could blame the EA side of things more than the Harmonix side or whatever. But this was really a problem with Nintendo and their hardware platform, which they did eventually update. As a matter of fact, Samba de Amigo for the Wii was the first one that offered DLC.
I know.
I should link that in the show notes,
that's,
too.
That's crazy to me. We'll get back to Samba in a second. But
yeah.
What I was trying to say about Final Fantasy...
Oh my God!
That's all right. Just, let's remember now. Let's go back
15 minutes ago.
Yeah. So, as I said, the Square Enix games, even in America, are more expensive.
Yeah.
You know, like when Final Fantasy IV for Nintendo DS or Chrono Trigger, or one of those titles comes out. Mm-hmm. You know, a normal DS game's $30-$35. Square Enix game is $35-$40. You know.
Right.
A lot of people call it the Square Enix tax.
Oh.
You know?
Yeah, you mentioned that in the previous episode.
But the only reason they can sell their games for that much is because of their company name.
Right.
If it's because people associate some of their fondest gaming memories. They're thinking of their adventures with Cloud and Tifa. They're thinking of, you know, while playing the original Chrono Trigger. You know, they're thinking, you know, there's a high... You know, developer worship.
Yeah.
But the thing is, a lot of people don't realize is a lot of the Square Enix things are Square Enix in that they have that name on it alone. Because, I mean, Square Enix for its DS titles outsources like crazy. They go to Feel Plus or Matrix or, you know, a bunch of like development houses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they give, okay, here's our property, here's where we see this game going, make it for us.
Yeah.
And so, like, the original developers who were involved in those series, especially the remakes, they're nowhere to be seen. But, you know, and then all kinds of developers do it. Nintendo does it.
Right.
You know, but sometimes when we see that logo, we're like, ah, the new game from Square Enix.
Right, yeah. Yep.
I've fallen for it. And some of those games have been fine. I mean, Square Enix, you know, doesn't release that much crap, you know.
Right. Unless you don't like any Final Fantasy game since, like, 9 or something like that.
Well, there's been some.
I haven't played one since 8, unless you count 10, which I didn't even finish. I didn't finish 8 for that matter.
You're killing me here. Neither of us.
No, I got the Blitzball, and it was so much more fun than the main story. I just...
But, yeah. Okay, we mentioned Blizzard.
Yeah.
And, oh, by the way, I was totally wrong. Upon thinking about it, it was Interplay who released Boogerman.
Oh, yeah, that's totally
like,
different.
The people who are writing me a letter right now, you can stop. I've realized it. But I get confused because... The early Blizzard games were all published by Interplay.
Right.
And who did Boogerman.
So it's easy to get confused there because a lot of the time it's hard to distinguish the publisher from yep. the developer because the developers weren't given top billing. So like Trade West published Battletoads, I think. And it says like in the title screen that it's a Rare game, but you don't really, I don't think it's on the package or on the cart itself. Trade West is a lot more prominent anyway.
If it is on the package, it's in really small print.
I can just go and get it. Hold on a second.
you happen to have a copy? Well, I guess I'm alone now, so I'm going to tell you that one of the best games that Blizzard ever made was Rock and Roll Racing for the, I believe it came out on Genesis and the Super NES. Fantastic game. Really good soundtrack, good play, kind of like Super Off-Road. Really, really nice. So if you're looking for like a classic racing game, isometric view, Rock and Roll Racing, Blizzard Entertainment.
I haven't heard of this.
I suppose you could play Diablo 3. Sean, I didn't hear you come in. Oh. Me and the audience were having a little chat about Rock and Roll Racing.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, actually, I did most of the talking.
All right, yeah, so... I have the cart in front of me. It says that okay. This nice, nice Battletoads logo, and then the actual, yep. like, the title... and Rash, I think. I can't tell which one this is in the front. And then, yeah, down at the bottom, there's Trade West, Nintendo Official Seal of Quality, and then licensed by Nintendo for play on the NES, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, there's no mention of Rare whatsoever on the packaging.
No, I don't think so. And some Rare games were released by Nintendo itself.
Mm, yeah.
Rad Racer, of course, is a good example. No, not Rad.
That was Square.
No, sorry. Rad Racer is Square Enix. Sorry. Yep. Slalom. I believe.
Slalom.
Maybe I'm confusing. In my mind, do I confuse Rare and Square Enix? This could be a problem.
Yeah, one's a Japanese company and one was an English company. I mean, still is, I guess, but we discussed the fate of Rare.
One makes avatars for Kinect now. So.
Yeah. Oh, goodness.
The other one just finds new and more elaborate ways to render Cloud's hair.
Oh, that one's not Rare then. Gotcha. Okay. Pretty sure anyway. One can never be too sure. Yeah. So I still think they
should make a 2D fighter that's Final Fantasy versus Banjo Kazooie.
Mm.
I'd buy that.
Yeah. Which episode did we talk about? Rare's fate. I do not recall.
We'll have to look through the archive.
Yeah, we'll link that in the show notes too. For those who don't know, whenever we say that, we want you to go to famicomdojo.tv/podcast, in this case /podcast/47 for episode 47, to see everything. So we're going to link the articles, we're going to link the videos, and have a little bit more to say about the things that we are just sort of riffing on right now. Because we don't script this show, not too much anyway.
There's some scripting involved.
There's bullet points, I guess.
I can't just wake up and be this charming.
Actually, in this case, I think you can.
Anyway, so what developer for you sells a game just by its name?
Well, anyone who's been listening to the show for a while will not be at all surprised that company is totally THQ. I mean, BioWare. I don't know.
Man, that's like reverse developer worship. Like, if a game's made by THQ, I mean, it could. Oh man, it ruins it.
Oh, I know, right? At least it's not who made the Back to the Future games.
Acclaim. And they got
published
exactly
it.
What they did. What
they published them.
Yeah.
Ah, well, whatever. That company, they're terrible. Anyway,
well, I can only assume that whatever company made that game, has for the sake of honor, just disposed with themselves.
Oh goodness!
I think the company should have committed seppuku.
Oh dear.
And Acclaim dug its own grave. So.
Yeah. Was Acclaim one of those other Atari spinoffs?
Yes. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Because you can tell when it's one of the Atari spinoffs because they all tried to get higher in the alphabet than the previous one.
Yeah, just so they could have higher stock.
So it was Activision, and then let's see, it was
Apple,
like Activision, Acclaim, Acclade. Yeah, they produced like the Test Drive series.
Oh,
they got bought out by somebody.
Well, Apple's one of them too, right? Because Steve Jobs used to work for Atari.
Yeah. But I mean, Apple was never a game developer. But yeah, I know.
Just
saying.
Yeah.
And then Absolute, which was started by David Crane, the guy who made Pitfall.
Oh yeah, all right.
He worked for Activision and then spun off his own company, which released the really fun game Battle Tanks.
I guess
a boy in his blob.
Oh, that's right, a boy. I had no idea that was the same guy.
And The Simpsons game for the NES, Bart versus the Space Mutants.
Yeah, did they also do Bart versus the World?
I'm not sure.
I mean, it's a similar style.
It is a similar style, but like I think
see the things you learn listening to the Famicom Dojo podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Well, you know, this isn't news though. That I love me a BioWare. I got Mass Effect. I had heard about KOTOR, that being Knights of the Old Republic, Star Wars. Yeah. But never really played it because I was like, Star Wars game, whatever. I didn't realize that was essentially the prototype for all these other games I would love that came afterwards. So Mass Effect, Dragon Age, Mass Effect 2, Dragon Age 2, Mass Effect 3, and presumably Dragon Age 3. But
yeah.
Mass Effect 3 was where a lot of people finally revolted, I guess, against their developer worship. And it's all because of the ending. And we've gone over that. But you know, people bought this game on the strength of the name. And I think a lot of the passion they have for it is just a testament to BioWare's ability to make really great games and to deserve to have someone buy it day one, sight unseen, and hope it's amazing. And I mean, is it okay for them to be let down by whatever expectations they built up? I mean, we've covered that in previous shows too, but
yeah,
I'll let you guys ponder that. But that's definitely a case of like people, I don't know, having expectations. It kind of dovetails the whole gamer entitlement thing.
Yeah, which we need to.
That's a whole separate topic, though.
Yeah, we should do that next week.
We've been
putting that off for a while, but
yeah,
gamer entitlement. Yeah. I think is very important.
Well, it's not just gamer entitlement. There's developer entitlement, and there's iPhone gamer entitlement, which is different from gamer entitlement. A little bit different. Yeah. So, I'm not in the camp who's angry at BioWare for the ending of Mass Effect 3. I didn't hate Dragon Age 2, even though its flaws compared to the first one are apparent. I still enjoyed it. I think just in general, like sequels of beloved franchises.
Don't hate the player, hate the game. Hate the game. Sorry.
Man, if we didn't have a title for this episode already, I would have gone with that instead. Oh, man. So what about you? Is there anyone else in the U.S. or Japanese or European side?
Well, I will. This is good. This has burned me a few times already, but will buy any game that Grasshopper Manufacture is involved with.
Oh, is that the studio that? Oh dear, we were at Tokyo Game Show.
Yes.
What was their big title there?
No More Heroes. Oh, the recent one.
Yeah.
Shadows of the Damned.
That's right. That was the one that's a Bori Endoshekshi or something like that, right?
It was like. Yeah, but
just go back and listen to the Tokyo Game Show episode.
That's a good game. I finally got a copy.
Oh yeah, because it'd be out now, wouldn't it? Yeah. Okay. Yep.
And it's good. It's good. The play control, like most Grasshopper titles, the play control is a bit wonky. The story's way twisted.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of inappropriate and misplaced sexual references.
Oh goodness.
Okay, I loved Killer 7.
Mm.
And then I loved No More Heroes.
Mm.
And from that point, I will buy anything they make.
Right.
Or are even remotely connected with. And there's the problem. Some of the things that they're only remotely connected with are not always great.
Oh, sure.
But like, I don't know if it, but the thing is, I think I've changed it. Like it's not a developer worship so much. Like, I'm not worshiping Grasshopper so much as I really like Suda Goichi. Right. Goda Suichi. Oh, dear. Sounds like a cheese.
Suda Goichi is just Suda 51 is how it's usually written out, because Goichi is just Japanese for 5-1.
And yeah, he was the lead in No More Heroes. He was he produced No More Heroes 2, which I think is why it is, in my mind, a weaker title. But he's working on Lollipop Chainsaw right now, and that game is one that I shall be buying.
I finally saw a trailer for that, because you got to go see it at Tokyo Game Show last year.
Yes.
And I didn't.
I played it at the Microsoft Pavilion.
Yeah, and speaking of inappropriate, you had to go into a adults-only area to even see the screen.
Yes, it was like there was a curtain. I felt really dirty about it, actually, because they were like, it's like adults only. And I'm like, what type of game is this? But like anything that's like too violent or, a lot of the games that looked way more adult only to me, some of those like RPGs with the young girls.
Yeah.
Those should have been in a separate section, but those were okay. But the Lollipop Chainsaw, you can't have that. But yeah, I enjoyed the 3 minutes of demo that I waited an hour and a half to play. But it looked really fun. Like, there's definitely nothing deep going on here, but I don't know how this company is still in business. Most of their games flop pretty hard.
Yeah.
Like, they have dedicated fans. Like, it's like a... But yeah, most of them just don't do very well. But yeah, I'll support them day one for most of their titles. And it's burned me a couple times. Okay, here's some of the common, gaming developer demigods.
Okay. Okay.
We've got Hideo Kojima.
Yep.
The Metal Gear guy. Yep. But he's released some duds.
Metal Gear Solid 4. Actually, I haven't played any of the Metal Gear Solid games, really. I played part of the first one. There's a whole episode of about our stack of shame. That you just listen to that, because I don't want to go over this again.
Yeah. And let's see, what are their idols? Miyamoto, of course.
Oh, naturally.
Shigeru Miyamoto. But, and then, gosh, who else? Yuji Naka, not so much anymore.
Right, and he's Sonic Team, right?
Sonic, yeah. Well, I mean, Sonic Team still exists, technically.
Right.
But he took, him and, 10 of his, closest Sonic Team guys, and they formed Probe.
What, have they done anything yet?
Yeah, they've done lots of games.
Huh.
Lots of interesting games.
But I mean, they've been releasing Sonic games since the Dreamcast that people didn't really set anyone's posteriors on fire.
Sonic Episode 4 was pretty good.
Oh, the DLC one, the 2D one.
Yeah, the episodic one.
Oh, oh! I didn't play that one either.
They just last week released episode 2 of it.
Okay. Sorry, I was thinking of Sonic 4.
That's Sonic 4. That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, just Sonic 4. I don't know what's going on there.
And it's episodic. Yeah, Sonic 4 episode 1, okay. Sonic 4 episode 2. And then I think you're thinking of what, Sonic Generations?
No. Yeah, I mean that was something different, and that's released on Xbox and PS3, and then there's a DS version that kind of ties into it, and that was a lot of fun to play.
That was nice.
Yeah. There's even like a throwback Sonic Adventure type mode in the console version for those who really want to play it that way, but there's no requirement, or maybe it has to do with completion. You have to do it in both modes to get the most gizmos, widgets, I don't know, whatever, whatever collection item they have in that. But yeah, that was like the first Sonic game that people didn't totally hate in recent memory. I mean, honestly, I think Sonic Team peaked with Samba de Amiga 2000. that was in 2000.
Yeah. It might have been 99, actually.
Yeah, I think it technically was 99, but yeah. I played it in 2001.
I know what you mean. Well, let me see. Think. What has Sonic Team done since then that I've liked? They did the New Knights.
Oh, yeah.
It was okay.
Yeah. They didn't do the Samba de Amigo for Wii. That was done by Gearbox.
Gearbox, yeah.
Gearbox, who doesn't do rhythm games.
I don't know. Western company.
Well, they're better known for shooters.
Yeah. Right?
So that was just weird.
That was. But, I mean, they tried. I think that's one where again, the Wii has to be blamed a bit.
Yeah, because the controls just weren't right for it. And I don't even think with the Motion Plus control, which wasn't even finalized at the time, I don't think it wouldn't have been a lot better.
I think it would have been better.
Well, I mean,
it wouldn't have been like the maracas that Sega had, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, just
it would have caught the shake motions much better, but the
positioning would have still been weird.
Yeah,
I think.
Although it would have been better. It would have been better. Yeah, the gyroscopes would have definitely helped.
Better, definitely. Just watch the review. We'll link it in the show notes for more details on that. But basically, the original set of maracas was ultrasonic or whatever. What the shoot? Ultrasound. Sorry, based.
Ultrasound.
Like the Power Glove. Same deal. So there's like a. You know, high frequency emitters between the maracas and the bass, and that's how it tells position by the wavelengths of sound. Science,
oh, really?
Science
I
is fun.
It was optical.
No, it's sound based. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. So that worked out pretty well because the positioning was fairly accurate, but then the quality. So it started to degrade after a while, especially with vigorous play like I and our particular group of college friends would put into it for a month at a time and get beefy arms like Popeye or something. But then like the Wii version's all position based. So you can try and play it like you did with the Dreamcast version, but it wouldn't really work. And then when you can just like, kind of like flip your wrist and hope it lands on the spot you want, especially in the super hard mode. It's not so accurate, and it's kind of frustrating. But for the lower difficulties, it's pretty playable.
So, Monkey. Is it just BioWare for you? Like, well, have you bought everything BioWare's made? Did you buy their Sonic RPG?
What?
BioWare.
Really?
They made a Sonic the Hedgehog RPG.
Huh.
I'm not making this up.
Well, I mean, I buy almost every like first party thing Nintendo puts out, and actually more like Miyamoto puts out, and then by extension Nintendo. So like I own Pikmin. I don't think I own Pikmin 2, but it was a fun game. It wasn't like, you know, groundbreaking like Mario-esque you know, levels of popularity or anything like that. And he hasn't been directly involved in the development of a Zelda game in a really long time. In fact, there was a lot of flap about him saying something about stepping down from his director of development position to actually get more hands-on again, and then like shares of Nintendo dropped like 2% the following day.
Yep.
It was pretty crazy. So you got to be careful about stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, I don't think that the games were any worse for his lack of direct involvement. Although he does seem to have sort of. For Japanese anyway, and the way they talk about things, seems to have some pretty strong opinions about the two different directors who tend to swap places and making their Zelda titles, and he tends to prefer one over the other, and by extension, so do I.
Well, I mean, he's kind of like the spiritual head of game development in Nintendo but like his new title. In the last decade has been Nintendogs.
Oh, yeah, which I never played.
I played it.
Or Nintendogs plus Cats.
I didn't. You know? But, I mean, that's fine. I mean, that's not my type of game. And that's the thing. You can definitely respect developers.
Mm.
But we get in kind of a, you know, if... That's why Kickstarter might be a risk.
Right. Yeah.
Because unlike a lot of games where like I love this series, I love this game, you know. We see the screenshots, we read the reviews, we buy it. But a lot of Kickstarters, we're going on blind faith of who's involved with it. Now, right. I supported the Leisure Suit Larry project because Al Lowe was directly involved. And right. the Leisure Suit Larry games where he wasn't involved were horrible. But, I mean, he hasn't made a game in like 15 years.
At least.
You know? I think his last one was, well, Larry 7. And that was 96? Later? 97? Either way,
well, there was
a long time.
Six was Love for Sale, right? And then there was one that was done by this like Chicago firm, like Magna Cum Laude or something like that.
Yes, I don't remember. It was actually, sorry, Nintendo fans, sorry, Conduit fans, but it was done by High Voltage Software.
High Voltage, do they even exist anymore?
Yeah, they made Conduit 2. Like, you remember, maybe you weren't following Wii at this time, but, like, they were, like, the great white hope, you know? They were like, this will save the Wii. And Conduit was a good game, and they made a new engine that's very, very nice. But, like, everyone thought that, like, they were going to save the Wii. And they made some games that were pretty good. But, like, I don't know. Yeah, you don't hear much about them anymore.
All I remember is that that Legion of Larry game came out right around the time I was living in Chicago, and I was applying the game to game development shops like Midway, which has since shuttered, and they kept trying to get me to go to Seattle. Because it's like, we have only internships here, but we got plenty of stuff there. I almost aced their C++ exam, by the way. So.
Nice.
So I put that out there. But so it was them and High Voltage, which were just down the road from me. Interesting times, but I didn't know anything about them, and this was pre-Conduit too, I imagine.
Yeah. Probably. At that point, they were probably, they were mostly known for their ports of like Baldur's Gate games to the consoles. Like Dark.
I love Dark. It's my favorite.
Baldur's Gate Dark something. Empire? Dark.
Man, that's terrible.
That. The one that... Wow. And they made the engine that powered the new Bard's Tale game.
Okay.
But not the game itself.
Right.
But anyway, so with this Kickstarter, and I've definitely fallen prey to developer worship because, like... If you have been watching the videos for Double Fine Adventure, have you?
Unfortunately, not. I'm a supporter on the Tim Schafer / Double Fine adventure game project, but I have actually not watched any of their videos beyond the first one.
But I mean, he basically goes into the fact that he didn't even have an idea for what the game would be when he started.
Well, that's fine. I just wanted an adventure game because I love adventure games. Exactly, I love Tim Schafer adventure games. Yeah, my developer worship is coming through here. In fact, I would go so far as to say if it weren't for developer worship, these Kickstarter campaigns wouldn't be possible.
I agree. I totally agree. Yeah, I mean, some of it falls into serious worship.
But right.
Like, I also pledged for Wasteland 2.
Okay.
But I pledged for it because I loved Wasteland, but I wouldn't have if it was like, help us let EA make a Wasteland 2.
Oh, you know? Right.
Well, good. It'll be a first-person shooter with DLC, you know?
Right. No. Well, these developers get to like skip out on the publishers because they get to pay for a lot of their development costs up front. And then, you know, I guess at the strength of their personalities got it funded in the first place, then it might get it sold, too.
I love, and now there's a new Space Quest, like the guys from Space Quest.
Yeah.
A new game in the Tex Murphy series.
Wow. Can we get the Williamses to like unretire and like come off their yacht wherever they're off yachting and?
Well, I mean, Telltale's making the new King's Quest right now, so.
I guess Telltale's okay. That's
which means that it'll probably be fairly good, better than most adventure games in the last decade, and that the characters will have plastic looking hair.
Oh, that's okay. I love the Back to the Future games, though.
Yes.
Telltale hasn't reached the developer worship stage for me yet, but I respect them for like continuing to find ways to make a dead or dying genre relevant again. And I felt like the Back to the Future games really did that.
I will buy most things that they release, but like they're like what they did, what, not CSI, a Law and Order game. No interest.
Oh,
yeah. I skipped their Jurassic Park game.
Oh,
I'll probably pick up their Walking Dead game because Telltale I like.
Wow, there's
Walking
a
Dead
Walking
I like.
Dead game?
You've been watching Walking Dead, right?
Sure. I love watching AMC. It's on AMC, right?
I don't know. I watch it on Hulu. But I believe it is. I love the idea of Kickstarter. I love the idea of Kickstarter, but I worry the bubble's going to break.
Right.
Because right now I've pledged money for I'm getting a new Leisure Suit Larry. I'm getting a new Tim Schafer adventure game. I'm getting a new Wasteland game. You know, like all these things that I really really liked. But all it's really going to take is one of them to really suck.
Yeah.
Like, I have a lot of faith in Tim Schafer, but you know, what if he produces a game that like goes, oh whoa, he can't really make adventure games anymore. You know.
Well, or would it be his fault in that case? Because then I'd be like, well, maybe the adventure game genre is just tapped out or something.
Yeah, when games are really bad, we can always go, it's not the developer's fault. Or when a game comes out bad, but it was like licensed by another company, we'll be like, it was the publisher who got involved ruined my hero's like artistic vision.
Yeah,
was compromised by the language. And in some cases, maybe it does happen, but in some, we're just grasping at straws.
All right, so now I know this isn't a video game, but there was an episode where the characters were in a video game. I think.
Are you referring to Community?
I am referring to Community, which we mentioned before. Since we've recorded our last podcast, NBC/Sony Picture Entertainment let him go from Community as the producer. And
you know Dan Harmon's from Wisconsin?
Is he?
Yeah, from Milwaukee.
He explains
so much.
He was
also a member of the Dead Alewives Watchtower. You might know them from the hilarious Dungeons & Dragons skit.
Oh, my God.
Where are the Cheetos, you know? No?
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Dan Harmon.
I cast Magic Missile?
Yeah. I don't remember which character he was, but yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, developer worship can kind of make us blind to the faults of our creators, and Dan Harmon was not shy about sharing his faults on Tumblr, much to the chagrin of his PR people.
Yep.
So there was a whole kerfuffle between him and
Chevy Chase,
and so it was about a month ago, and it was very well publicized, and he wasn't supposed to say anything about it, but if you go to his Tumblr, he talks about it in very vague terms, just saying that he could be a better producer, he has certain failings there, but he always tries to make entertaining stuff for people, and that's where he wants to leave it. And so you put that together with his sudden exit and then his explanation that he was not asked to leave or asked to step aside or ask anything. The decision was made without him, probably based on a long history of issues like this culminating in the Chevy Chase incident.
Yep.
So one could say he brought it upon himself. And the fact that he's so vocal about it can kind of make you, you know, think to yourself, okay, I guess he's not the greatest at the job he did, but you know, those aren't the parts that I care about. I care that he gave us a good television week after week. Or in the case of last week, three times in one day.
I don't know how involved he was in the show. I mean, he was the showrunner, but, you know.
Yeah.
It might have just been a very you know, there's good writers. The guy who played Starburns was a writer for it as well.
Oh, was he? Oh, man. Yep. Okay.
That's why he didn't really want to be an actor.
Right.
But
doesn't sound like BJ Novak in Office.
Yep. Yeah. Well, he is a stand-up comedian as well, so. But most of the people who are on The Office are like also the writers.
Right, right. Kind of like people who work at Harmonix are also musicians. So that's like a very tightly knit, you know, between their craft.
And people who work on the Famicom Dojo podcast also
make games. We play. Maybe we'll make games one day. No, I brought up the community thing because it's like even if like the honest candor of the creator can't make me hate him. What can, you know, like what will knock down this company a peg if a bad game won't, or, you know, PR disaster or whatever.
He joins THQ.
Okay. Dead to me.
Dead to me. Yeah.
All right. So maybe you guys out there have an idea of like what developers could do to, sort of pry themselves away from your love and can they make a bad game? Can they make enough bad games for you to stop loving them?
No.
I think Yuji Naka did. Honestly,
I
never loved him in the first place. Is the problem?
My love of him just changed a little bit. It used to be like I loved him like as a father who bestowed upon me great presents.
Yes.
And now it's like a father who's old and kind of senile, but like still kind of sweet.
That'll be you one day.
You just want to care for him, and he's like, I've made a new game with Prope, and you're like, let me see. Oh, that's lovely.
Oh goodness. So if you want to leave your thoughts or hate mail, go to famicomdojo.tv in the show notes. This one's podcast/47. Also,
tell us who you worship. I want to see who you're following.
Definitely, like, and if they have Twitter accounts or Tumblrs that we can read about their exploits, post those links for everyone else to check out too. You can also share that stuff on Twitter for Famicom Dojo, Facebook Famicom Dojo, our free iTunes storefront, and now, as we've mentioned at the top of the show, Stitcher.
Does Stitcher have comments?
Nah, probably not. But they have links to our show notes, hopefully, from our description. So, and you can follow
more and more ways to experience Famicom Dojo, and more ways coming. We've got a secret project we're working on right now.
Yes, we have a not so secret project that of our upcoming videos, and a secret project that is something else.
That is not a video.
Well, there's a video in it.
Podcast.
Yeah, there's a podcast in it, sort of, too.
And to narrow it down even farther, it's not a monkey.
Oh.
I know that's where you're going, but it's not.
Don't give them too many hints.
I'm not going to give too many hints. I'm not going to give too
That
many
monkey
hints.
Thing was a bridge too far.
I know.
All right. But so, we do this every week.
What that might be, too.
So we do this every week, or we try to anyway. We are back on the wagon, so that feels pretty good. So join us next week
It does. So join us next week for actually being here next week.
We'll even tell you our topic. We'll do the we'll do the gamer entitlement, the gamer entitlement, developer entitlement, iPhone entitlement, all that stuff. We'll hit all that up. Sounds good. So
it's gonna be.
Yeah, all right, until next week, the dojo is closed. That's never going to work, is it?
No, we need it.
All right.
We need a different, we could just go with the red bean closing today.
Okay.
Keep your stick on the ice. No,
come on.
That's not going to work.
No.
Goodbye. Well, yeah.
Famicom Dojo.